And today's Tailwind Tip of the Trail is brought to you by the fastest known time unsupported record holder of the Tahoe Rim Trail, JB Benna. JB, what's your tip of the trail?
As David Horton, one of my mentors, said, minimize the mistakes.
Ooh, that is wisdom.
Short, sweet, and profound. Minimize the mistakes.
And then get past them.
Well, mistakes are going to come, regardless of what race you're on or what you're doing. You have to accept them when they come at you. And I think that's just great advice. Minimize those. And when they present themselves, don't let them escalate, right? I've got to think that as they show up, don't let them grow.
Exactly.
Well, thank you, JB. We appreciate your time. And go to tailwindnutrition.com. Take the Tailwind Nutrition Challenge and get yourself a sample pack. They have the new Naked flavor.
It's filled with calories, 100 calories per scoop. They have all the electrolytes you need, and it's not too sweet. It's savory and stays with you all day long. We've talked to a lot of people that have been on 50-mile runs completely supported by Tailwind Nutrition. So go out and drink.
Boss.
And today's podcast is brought to you in part by Audible Books. You can go audiblepodcast.com/TRN, and you can sign up and get a free Audible book download. And today's suggested audiobook is...
Well, I'm going to make today's suggestion, Scott.
Okay, great.
You made the last one, and this one is from a author that we've had on the podcast, Peter Larson.
Two authors.
That is correct. Peter Larson and Bill Katofsky. They both put together Tread Lightly, and it's about footwear and the quest for injury-free running, and that's what we're all after.
What trail runner doesn't want to download this podcast and listen to it while they're running?
How modern runners... Here are some of the things that they address on that.
Okay.
The pros and cons of barefoot running. That's one of the items they talk about, Scott.
Okay.
How modern runners differ from their ancestors. You've got to imagine there are a few differences besides a GPS watch, right?
Shoes.
Possibly. And how have the shoes evolved? They take a hard look at the evolution of shoes. And to me, that's interesting.
We're all shoe geeks, aren't we?
Well, you know, most of my days start with shoes, Scott, and they end taking them off. So I have an intimate relationship with shoes. And as I look at this book, I find it's hard sometimes in my day to sit down and thumb through page after page, even though that would be an activity that I would choose. And what I like about Audible is you can download, plug the book right into your ear and stay productive, either running or doing yard work, whatever you're doing.
Doing the dishes?
You can. So I would say my recommended book for a free download from Audible is Tread Lightly by Peter Larson and Bill Katofsky.
Okay, here's the quiz.
What is the quiz, Scott?
Where do you go to get that free download, Don? Audiblepodcast.com.
Audiblepodcast.com/TRN. TRN. Get yourself a free book, educate yourself, and become and tread lightly.
Moss. And now another Petzl running strategy from my co-runner, Don Freeman.
Scott, today we're going to talk a little bit about strategy for managing injuries. It's important. Most of the things that happen to us are cumulative in nature in this sport. I mean, certainly you can catch a toe and twist an ankle or land on something and create some trauma. But so many of these things that we have, an achy knee, some plantar fasciitis, all of the stuff comes from just repeat use over and over. And what my tip is, or strategy, is this: become aware of what's coming on, and it shouldn't sneak up on you. You see it coming and you need to modify early.
So is this something like you do when you're racing? Could we do a body inventory?
Well, we should probably be body inventorying all the time, right? So if you're starting to feel a bit of modifying your training. So this isn't so much race day. This is during the training the months ahead. It takes several weeks to turn an injury around if you wait too long. Or you can modify gait, modify your activity, do some cross training, and avoid something completely in just a few days of modifying. But you have to be able to see it coming early. So be honest with yourself and be true to yourself and be a realist and watch and listen and modify.
That's a great tip. That's a great strategy.
And another great strategy, Scott, is to put on a decent lamp and avoid those big traumas that can happen out there.
I don't use a lamp anymore, Don.
What, Scott, do you use?
I use a Petzl torch.
Oh, yeah, similar to our friend from across the pond,
Warren Pohl. He calls them torches. And I have decided that torch is a better descriptive word for what I wear on my head right now.
Well, I think a Cocopelli would wear a torch.
Actually, it would.
He would not wear a lamp.
It's,
yes.
Yeah. When I think of a lamp, I think of something at the a little tiny bulb that you have at your bedside that you try to read at night with. That is not what this Petzl now is. The Petzl now is a torch. It illuminates. It illuminates the trail. It makes it safe. And you know, a lot of people. I've had some people ask me. They say, you know what, Scott? Yeah. I like the idea of the now, but it's awfully pricey. And you know what I come back with them, Don?
What do you say?
I say, how much did you spend on your last pair of shoes? And I say, okay, how long did that last you? Well, a headlamp should last you
a very, very long time. You don't wear those out.
Through dozens of pairs of shoes.
That's right.
It's a good investment for trail running, for your safety.
And I will tell you probably the piece that I like about it is that it's always charged. I always have a full battery in that thing. I'm not out there with a 50% battery. It's rechargeable, and that's probably been one of my favorite parts. Go to Petzl.com. Check out the variety of torches, Scott.
Yes.
And torch.
Moss.
Are we recording?
I'm stretching my groin.
I'm not nervous. I got this. Let's just do it. I'll say I'm Faith Goss. You say I'm Don Freeman. Okay. Faith Goss is not one of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
And action. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I am Scott War.
And I'm Don Freeman. And today with us, we have Anton Krupicka. And boy, you know,
I think I've heard of him.
If you've been around the sport for any amount of time, you know who Anton is. And he is an amazing runner. He's won Leadville 100 two times. He's got a trophy there for Miwok 100K, the Rocky Raccoon 100 miler. He owns a victory there. Collegiate Peaks 50 miler, the White River 50 miler. Wherever he goes, he's a threat for that finish line. And we'd like to welcome Anton.
Hey, thanks, Tony, for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me. And I have to commend you for having sort of this perfect pronunciation of my last name.
See, Don?
Yeah.
That was very good.
I wanted to make sure. I checked with Scott and make sure it was right because, you know, we've heard it several different ways. But and I think we've watched that one indulgence trailer, watching your running form from the side view, slow motion by that river, I don't know how many times. Not only on YouTube, but also mentally, just watching that gate, because that's
we'll of course link that to the podcast description. But sometimes when Don and I are running in the morning, I start singing that French song.
It's not good. I kind of fantasize that that's maybe my running gait that it makes him remind of that song. But I'm afraid it's not.
So. You know, with that, here's my first question.
All right.
So how did you develop such a good running gait? And That's question number one. And question number two is, after so many years of running, do you still work on your running form? Do you think about it when you're running?
It's funny because I kind of get this question a fair bit, and I'm always a little frustrated with it because I'm not 100% happy with my form, I guess. Mm. I feel like I'm a little too upright. And my legs kind of flare out a little when I'm running, and my arms are a little stiff. So I don't know. It's the only thing I've ever done to work on my form was 9 years ago in 2004. I consciously shifted from what was a pretty prominent heel strike to more of a midfoot strike, you know, facilitating that with wearing more minimal shoes and doing a fair amount of barefoot running on grass. And that, over the course of maybe a month or so, my form definitely adjusted to more of a midfoot strike, shorter, quicker strides. I don't know if what my form was like before that. I've never had any video of it, but I was doing that consciously. And since then, it's more just been about trying to get down the trail as efficiently and quickly as possible, I guess, and not doing a whole lot of thinking about what my body is doing. A couple years ago, I got a gait analysis here in Boulder because I was having some injury issues, and I definitely have a pronounced sort of upright stance that makes me a little uncomfortable whenever I see some videos of myself running, and allegedly has maybe contributed to a couple of injury issues I've had, but yeah. I don't know. Yeah, that was a long answer.
No, I mean, that's why we're here, for long answers and shorter questions. But
didn't want to listen to us.
Yeah, we've been on here before. You know, that upright stance, I've taken that as a positive thing as I'm looking at it for, say, the endurance runs, you know, the out there for a long time runs, because if you're leaning forward, gravity's working against you, and you have to fight the extra stress of being pushed down from gravity. So I'm thinking upright in the spine in a neutral position is just more efficient. So I was giving you hats off for that upright posture.
Oh, I mean, and that is true. You know, at the slower paces that, you know, we're generally running during ultras, it is fairly efficient to be upright like that. But if you are trying to run faster, pretty much across the board, you need to just, you know, a couple degrees of forward lean, you know, from your ankles. And I suppose when I go a little faster, I probably have a little more of a forward lean, but yeah, it's sort of a distinct thing. The other thing I do that is sort of frustrating for me is my foot plant it crosses the midline on, you know, subsequent strides. So this kind of ends up being this sort of egg beater motion instead of just a straight forward and back neutral stance, I guess. And that is part of sort of, it's been suggested that that might have contributed to some of the shin issues I've had in the past. And so I don't know, every now and then I'll focus on that and be like, okay, don't cross the midline so much and maybe lean forward a touch more. But usually I'm just trying to stay on my feet while running down some technical trail or something.
You know. Staying upright.
So when you're out there on a long run, do you check in on your gait occasionally, or are you just more focused on being efficient in your surroundings and foot placement, or do you check in and say, how am I doing?
Yeah, like I said, you know, if I'm on some smoother terrain or something, yeah, for sure, especially in a longer run or longer race where you're out there for hours and hours, what I usually end up thinking about is keeping the cadence high, because it's easy when you're fatiguing to sort of start plodding more, I think, or feel like you're plodding along. And as long as I'm keeping the cadence nice and snappy, I think, you know, being as efficient as possible, man.
That's a gold nugget right there.
That's a great tip.
Watching cadence to make sure that you don't get lethargic and just kind of in the wrong groove or zone and easy to get stuck there. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So I'm amazed at your comment earlier that within a month you had, in your opinion, transformed your running gait in just a month. I mean, besides besides running, you know, barefoot on the grass and doing that sort of stuff, I mean, did you do any drills, or was the minimalist footwear and running barefoot on the grass it?
I mean, again, this all was almost 10 years ago, you know, but yeah, I was just very conscious about it. You know, I was, you know, maybe it was a month or 2 months, but I was on every single run, I was focusing on more of this midfoot strike and doing the barefoot running at the end of each run on a grass field really kind of helped enforce that. You know, and back then I ran barefoot a lot, you know, as I was transitioning to more minimal footwear. I mean, I would do 30-minute runs with kind of all kinds of surfaces barefoot. And since then, I've gotten older and developed a few neuromas, and there's not a whole lot of barefoot going on anymore if I'm not on sand or grass. But when you're running barefoot a lot, it you know, a heel strike is almost impossible if you're on any kind of hard surface. And So it enforces it pretty quickly. And then, especially when you're running as much mileage as I do, and that it becomes second nature pretty quickly,
Well, I was going to say probably the reason why you were running a lot barefoot back then was you probably didn't have the shoe sponsor and you were a starving student.
Shoes
were hard to come by.
It is true. You know, I was definitely buying my shoes, but I did it all because I had 12 or 13 stress fractures when I was younger, and I wanted to try something different, and so I ditched my fiberglass orthotics and transition to more minimal footwear. And I've had plenty of injuries in the past 10 years, but none of them have been stress fractures. So, yeah.
Before I don't know what the moment was, the epiphany for the running community that we really need to, or maybe it was just for me being aware of looking at our running gait. I never even thought for the many years that I was running even about my gait. And if I look back at some old pictures from some races, it was obvious I didn't think about my gait because I was, I was Scooby-Doo. I was Shaggy on Scooby-Doo. I don't know who I was. I was reaching out with my heel and seeing how much real estate I could get. But I think real beneficiary from just the awareness of gait. I think it's saved a lot of injuries for me and increased my level of pleasure of the sport by keeping it light and easy.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Chris McDougall's book had a lot to do with that and raising the consciousness in the general running community. But I'm not convinced that one's gait is really all that important, that if you're getting out there and running on a regular basis and enjoying it, your body's going to find the most efficient way eventually. I don't know. Maybe I've always had sort of an efficient gait, so I'm biased and don't know the struggles people can have. But I just think getting out there is way more important than being overly concerned with how you're doing it. But, yeah.
Agreed.
So I want to discuss this for a minute. According to the stuff we've read, you ran your first marathon at age 12, and then couple that with the high mileage that you often talk about, up to 200 miles a week. How have you been able to do that for such a long time without serious injury?
I think most people would argue that I've been injured a lot. I have. A couple of things. First, I haven't seen a 200 mile week in over 3 years. My running's changed a lot over the last couple, 3 years. And, I focus much more on I don't even track miles anymore. I track volume by time. And then, the other way I quantify my running is vertical feet gained. I do a lot more uphill running and downhill running now. But also, I don't know, I don't race nearly as often as a lot of my peers in the ultra community. Some of that's deliberate. I want to still be racing years from now. And I think doing, more than half a dozen ultras in a year starts being pretty stressful year after year. So I don't know, I've sort of consciously just picked races that I really care about and go for that rather than, doing the odd 50K or 50 miler every month, as, you'll see some athletes do.
We've had similar discussions around here and on trail runs that you only have so many racing years in you. And what if you put them all together and just try to race, all year long, that the body eventually just fatigues from that either mentally or breaks down, physically from that kind of demand on you. So stretching out and pacing yourself sounds like a good strategy. There's a lot of talented runners that are only there for, 7 or 10 years, and then what happened to them?
Yeah, 7 or 10 years I think would be a pretty long stretch to be doing really well, actually. But, yeah.
So do you prescribe to taking during your, let's say, a typical running year, do you prescribe it to a running vacation where you take a vacation from your running and you do other things besides running and just lay off running, or are you just too addicted to being up climbing the mountains?
Well, unfortunately, you know, over most of my running career, those I don't know, breaks from running have been sort of imposed by some kind of injury, you know, and I haven't had to plan them. But this year, in the last couple of years, it's been a little different in that around this time of year in the fall, my body's just kind of done, you know, like I'm sort of more of a, like an endocrine level, I would say. You know, I'm just burnt out. Not mentally. I'm usually super psyched this time of year because I really like the weather, but my body just, you know, you go out for a run and you're putting in way more effort for like less than what you, you know, all summer long, maybe, you're having really good runs. And then this time of year, I don't know, my body goes to some kind of lull. So, I mean, I just came off of the last 6 weeks, most like September, I think I ran 7 or 8 times, because I raced UTMB right at the end of August. Mm-hmm. And then just the last 2 weeks, I've been jogging like an hour a day. And then just this week, I've started training with more focus again.
Can we talk a little bit about New Balance? Because I've got it. Here's my image, Tony. I've got you in the lab over there, and they're setting you up in different things. Then they make you go climb a hill and come back, and they log in a report. What's happening over there with the scientists in the laboratory at New Balance, and where's your piece in that cog over there?
So you're talking about like shoe design and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've actually been in their performance lab once, and that was 5 years ago. but at the time it was one of only a couple in the country, and they had all these force plates and the special treadmill and this whole thing. Uh-huh. They're, you know, really analyzing gait and all that. But, how it works usually is, you know, after 6 or 7 years or whatever it is now that I've been with New Balance, I have a close relationship with the designers and the product line managers, and we just have a pretty consistent back and forth on email and phone calls and that sort of thing, and sending prototypes back and forth on whatever shoe we're working on. Typically, it's been a shoe in this the 100 series, I guess. You know, started with the 100 back in 2008, and then the 101, and then the 110, and then now we're working on the 110 V2. It's just there. We'll talk about where we want the shoe to go, and then they'll draw something, and then they'll turn it into a prototype and send it to me, and I'll try it out. And, you know, this goes back and forth for a long time. I mean, the 110 V2, I've been running in prototypes of that for the past year, like literally since last October, November. And that shoe isn't going to come out until the middle of next year. So it's a long process. You know, 18 months is pretty typical, and I don't know. I that's kind of the way it works. They're very receptive to my feedback, and kind of the shoes that I've helped, you know, that they've built with me have shifted over the years toward my like kind of personal running needs and preferences, and yeah, it's been great.
So when we see a shoe that's made its final evolution, there's been quite a bit of input from you as you've trail tested and helped morph it into what we see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, always, of course, there's always compromises and timelines that sort of affect the final product. But yeah, once in that particular series of shoes, once it gets on the shelf. Yeah, like I said, I've already been looking at it for over a year, probably, and there will be things in that shoe that I can specifically point to, like that's there because I asked for it, you know, and which is pretty rewarding, and I feel really grateful and lucky, really, you know, to be, you know, on that kind of creative and design process.
Absolutely.
You know, that rolls us into a question I had about in the movie In the High Country, which again we'll link the Vimeo link where the Nation members can go and either rent it for $10 or you can buy the movie for $15, I believe. We'll link that to the podcast description. But in that video, there's a few scenes where there's a pair of brand new shoes and they grind the sole down to nothing, and then somebody is putting on, looks like some other kind of, the only stealth rubber, like 5'10" climbing shoes. They're putting some kind of stealth rubber on there. Is that what that is? Is a climbing shoe?
Yeah,
rubber?
That's exactly what's going on. That's a local shop here in Boulder. It's called Rock and Resole. It's just a climbing shoe resoling shop, and that's exactly what we're doing, is grinding off the factory outsole and applying. You can get two different kinds of rubber there, but the rubber we're putting on is the 510 stealth rubber, which is super sticky. Actually pretty terrible for running, but tolerable enough that it makes a great shoe for scrambling the flat irons here and then running in between them to the next one and scrambling, that sort of thing. That's what's going on there.
So you kind of opened up about the movie. Let's talk a little bit about that movie, because, Anton, you're not only a runner, but you've been featured in several films. We have Unbreakable with J.B. Benna. We got to see that.
Indulgence,
and now this new one, In the High Country, which is got a chance to watch. And it's if you need some motivation to go out, and I'm not talking to you, Anton, if you listeners need some motivation to go out and run, plug that thing in, because you won't get much past that introduction before you say, I think I need to go out and run a few miles.
And I will tell you, it's exactly that. It's not a feature-length film. It's only like 35, 36 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was watching it late one night until it was like midnight. And when I got done, I thought, I could go run. Even though I have an early morning, I think I can go out and run for a couple hours tonight. I mean, it was that motivating. I was thinking, I think I'd like to go do that right now.
So tell us how this movie came about. What happened? Joel Wolpert is the producer or the filmmaker, and how did it come together?
Sure. Joel and I met 3 years ago now. He did a short little piece on me for Running Times called The Runner in Winter, like a 10-minute film. The simple premise just being, let's make a little movie about running in the wintertime to kind of motivate people to run that time of year when it's a little less appealing. And we kind of clicked, just our personalities and sort of motivations in the sport. And so last year, sometime in the middle of the summer in 2012, he contacted me. He was interested in doing kind of a longer, more artistic piece about running in the mountains that wasn't a documentary or really paying attention to, any particular event, but rather was just kind of trying to capture a lifestyle, or a motivation or a way of being in the mountains. And I was game, just because I'd worked with Joel before and like the guy, and so he came out the week of the Leadville 100 last year, so that he would have a little time to acclimate to the altitude while I was recovering from the race, and we shot for the month following that. He followed me around, and I did my normal thing, and he took a lot of video, and then he came out this past spring three separate times for about a week each time to get some very focused shots in the mountains and to get a little different season stuff too. And then he edited it, and it came out middle of July this year.
You know, the interesting thing, and I think the unique thing of this film versus any other running video I've seen, is Manifest. I think it's the end where it goes through some of the credits. It says featuring Anton Krupicka, featuring the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. So the Rocky Mountains were, the second bill to you. They were a character in this video. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, and that was very intentional on Joel's part, obviously. I mean, Joel's, it sounds cliche and sort of overused, but he's definitely an artist, and he has an eye for the aesthetic, and I think he was trying to get that across in this film for sure. And I don't know, you've seen the film, the land is an important piece of the whole film, and I think he's just sort of paying homage to that.
Yeah, I don't know what what I know about photography. I've already said on this podcast, which is zero. But I can recognize, some high quality landscape, and some of the views are just fantastic as you look through there. And He has a picture. He has a shot of. Was he following you down some of the technical on that terrain? Because I was waiting for that camera to get close to the ground real quick because you were moving pretty good.
Yeah, Joel is. He's a really good runner. He's a really good athlete. He's a better climber than he is a runner even. And but there, some of those shots, some of those following shots are only possible because he's a very good technical runner. You know, there's in the sport, there's a lot of good runners out there, but a lot of them aren't very good on technical terrain. Joel's really good on technical terrain. And he's just an athletic guy, you know, and it requires that kind of coordination and agility. But then also he's shooting with, it's called a glide cam, steady cam. Basically it's just counterweights to lower the center mass of the whole camera. And, that way it takes out a lot of the shakiness. And then I don't think he did any post-production smoothing. Yeah, that's how those shots are gotten. And you know, it wasn't one continuous shot. There's a lot of stop and go for that stuff because it's really hard work to be carrying about a 7-pound camera in front of you and not falling and all that sort of thing. So but it wouldn't, those shots wouldn't be possible if you didn't have Joel's kind of athletic skill set in there as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, when I take videos of myself with my GoPro running down the trail, there's a lot more shakiness. You know, one of the quotes that I actually wrote down from the movie, first of all, I think this is also unique because I don't know if you wrote all of the dialogue in there, but you did the narration or most of the narration. Did you write most of that stuff?
That was a collaborative effort between Joel and I. You know, I've written a lot of stuff that's on the internet, and we kind of took that as a starting point. And then Joel and I sort of collaborated on really condensing kind of the core themes from a lot of my writings down to these sort of sound bites. And then eventually, like right before we actually recorded the voiceover, went through it essentially word by word to make sure we had kind of the word, had picked the words that we really wanted. So it was very much a collaborative effort between Joel and I.
Well, I was going to say, it seemed like each word was really thoughtful in which phrase and which word you were using. There was a quote, and I'm gonna quote it, that I loved. You say, "The mountains teach our insignificance as well as our agency." Think about that, Don Freeman.
Thank you.
That's deep, Tony. That's deep philosophy.
Well,
you pulled that out from your undergraduate's degree, didn't you?
Well, you know, I mean, I think about all this stuff a lot because I spend a lot of time doing it, and I guess have a tendency to, attach too much meaning to maybe your activities. But I don't know. I guess you know what I'm trying to say there. What we're trying to say there is, going into the mountains to challenge yourself and sort of confront your weaknesses and overcome obstacles and that sort of thing. It can be very empowering, you know? I guess that's what I'm talking about with the agency part, is, you know, realizing sort of your ability to, kind of impose your, your being into the world. But then your insignificance is obvious. I mean, every time I go into the mountains, you're humbled and realize just how sort of what a tiny speck you are in this vast world. And so, it's a twofold thing, I guess, you know, for me. And it's probably, those are the two main reasons I go into the mountains, I guess, is, you know, to feel small and also to feel strong.
Nice. Do you ever put in, do you ever bring music with you? Is that the part? I mean, listening to you, it sounds like that music would get in your way because you're trying to become one with the mountain and listen to the message and think about in a deeper meaning what's going on out here. Is music ever part of your journey?
No, music, I've never run with music. And if I did, I could only see myself doing it, in the city or on a road or something, certainly not in the mountains. And it's not that when I'm out there in the mountains, I'm not really thinking about this stuff that much. The whole point is sort of to be clear, to have the mind be clear, and to let your mind wander wherever, you know. And I find that my mind kind of darts around a lot when I'm running, and yeah, music would just be a distraction, though, from both my surroundings and sort of from my own, like, kind of internal world as well.
On the same vein, I want to ask you this question about when we do things that are long and you know, potentially painful, because that's part of the process of long events, we disassociate from some of that. How do you, can you disassociate and stay present at the same time?
No, I don't think you can, personally. I mean, I can't. And dissociation is something that I definitely don't use in long races or even long runs. I would say that, you know, it goes back to kind of the same thing as, the use of painkillers or ibuprofen or something in a race. Mm-hmm. I want to feel what it's like to run 100 miles. I don't want to numb out from it, you know. And if that means that it's going to be more difficult, then that's the way it is. Running 100 miles is hard, you know. I find, I guess, when I'm racing that I'm really focused. And I never get bored. I certainly am in a lot of pain or can get tired mentally from focusing. But I'm usually concerned just about when I'm going to eat next, if I should be drinking, should I hike or run this, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't get bored, really, I guess.
Okay, that brings up the question I've been begging to ask this whole podcast. As you could see, Don, I've had a big sign saying it's my turn to ask a question.
All right, Scott, go ahead.
In a lot of the videos,
put your sign down.
In a lot of the videos that we see and the footage that we see, yeah, those are clips and you know little tiny snippets. But when I picture or when I hear the name Anton Kropitschka, and I'm sure everyone else thinks the same thing. They think of the long hair, bearded guy, no shirt, 5K shorts. And nothing else. I can't imagine, or that's my question. Do you go out for a long run? And I do know because you recommended a trail when I was out in Boulder a year or two ago. You recommended a trail for me to go run. Which, by the way, that was not a trail. That was a mountain that I climbed. I did no running.
You saw some goats out there.
So I know exactly. I know what those flat irons are, and there's no running. At least for someone at my level. But when you go out for a 2-hour run and you put on, mm-hmm. let's say it's not so cold outside, but you put on your shorts and you're not wearing your shirt, do you take water? Do you take some nutrition, some goos? And if you do, where do you put them?
For a 2-hour run?
Let's say 3-hour run. 3-hour run.
At what length?
Probably not. Yeah, past 3, I would. I would take maybe one goo up to, you know, it depends. Beyond 3 hours is when I start bringing nutrition. In terms of water, it also depends. If I'm down here in Boulder, I might bring like a half-liter bottle with me. And fill it along the way at various spots. But up high in the mountains, it's the same sort of thing. The bottle I'm bringing with me is almost more of a cup to like dip from streams and drink with rather than a reservoir to really carry water with. There's a lot of water to drink in the high mountains and, I don't feel the need to carry it, I guess.
So contrast that with race day. So race day, mm-hmm. we're talking about a 100-mile race. You're going to be out there for
17
hours. The rest of us can be out there for 28. But you're out there for 17 mm-hmm. hours. What is your hydration and nutrition plan going into that? Do you start hydrating and taking nutrition from the first aid station on, or do you go ahead and just do it by feel? Is there a strategy behind that?
It's way different on race day. After the first hour, I'm eating and drinking. You know, I start the day off with a breakfast of, I don't know, between 500 and 1,000 calories. You know, an hour before the start, and it's much different race day. I'm drinking and eating all day long. It depends on the race, how much water I'm carrying with me. You know, a race like Western States, super hot, I'll probably be, you know, double fisting the water bottles. But like at UTMB this summer, same sort of thing. I had like a half liter bottle with me that, you know, I kept full, but it was often, I mean, that's a pretty cold race. You know, you're running at night for a lot of it, and you're in the high mountains. It's chilly, and there's lots of water along the course, so it wasn't an issue. But I'm eating 2 or 3 gels every hour, if not more. It depends on how hard I'm going. So, yeah, it's much different. In training, I'm just trying to, like, do as little as possible because it's annoying to carry that stuff. In racing, I'm trying to perform to my best abilities, and that requires sugar and water, you know?
So let's transition now to, you know, if you look at your race schedule over the last, let's say, 6 or 7 years, where there was a lot of races, and now there's fewer and fewer races each year. And you mentioned that you're being very specific and selective on which races you're going to go out there and do. But then you did this attempt at the Nolan's 14 this summer, a fastest known time. Which do you prefer? Do you prefer being out there on your own and giving yourself your own challenge and trying to compete against yourself, or the clock in a fastest known time? Are you finding more motivation or desire there versus an organized race?
Yeah, I can't really pick between the two. I do each for much different reasons, and I get different satisfaction out of each. The sort of the personal project type thing is, it's like pure inspiration. You know, it's being inspired by the mountains and the landscape and some geographic line that you can see on the terrain, you know. You know, Nolan's makes a lot of sense because it's these 14 peaks right in a row, and it's like, oh, you should link all those up in a single push. But racing is much different. It's two things, really. It's ego and community. I race to beat other people and to push myself really hard, and because you never push as hard as you do, as at least I don't, as when I'm in a race. But then also, races in this culture are the meeting point for the community. You know, it's where you get to hang out with other runners and other like-minded individuals, and that's really fulfilling in its own way. And that's why I enjoy racing. So I can't really pick between the two. I will say that in this next year, after not doing 100 mile in the first half of the summer this year to focus on Nolan instead, I'm motivated to focus more on organized racing this next year in 2014. I guess just because, oh, I'm 30 now, and I feel like, you know, Nolan's is something that I could do just as well or even better when I'm 40 as I am now, but you know, when I'm 40, I probably won't be able to race 50 miles as well as I can right now. So,
you know, I'm glad you explained that, because I think there may be a misconception, maybe, of you, in that, you know, you're a minimalist, you like to be out in nature and kind of a loner. But I like that you clarified that you really enjoy that running community and being with the nation of trail runners.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all my best friends are runners, and I'm a human, and I think the human animal is a social animal, and yeah, it's a big part, and there's a lot of really cool people in this sport, and they're inspiring to be around, and it's just fun having the sort of the fraternity, you know.
So talk to us about Nolan's 14. We talked about it a little bit on another podcast with another guest. Tell, what is the Nolan's 14 in summary? What is it, and how did you decide, hey, I think I'm going to take a shot at breaking that course record?
Right. So Nolan's 14 is in the Sawatch Range in central Colorado here, and there's 14 peaks in a row that are all over 14,000 feet. And you can link them up in less than 100 miles if you know the right routes. And I first really became interested in, I guess, 2 years ago when I broke my leg, and I started doing a lot of really hard uphill hiking and kind of like off-trail stuff too. And so it was the first time that I really became specifically fit for something like Nolan's 14. So it caught my interest then. And so last year, 2012, I spent most of the summer scouting the route and learning it, because a lot of it is off trail. A lot of it's, there might be some class three, but there's a lot of class two, you know, which is callous basically. And, yeah, but I never had time to give it a shot because I ended up doing the Lebda 100. And then, so this year I decided, okay, I'm going to like make the conscious decision to basically not do, when I didn't do the Hard Rock, I was like, well, I'm going to decide not to do the Western States 100 and instead do Nolan's. And, so I spent the whole first half of the year focusing on that, and really the first half of the summer, and then gave it a shot at the end of June, and just ended up having a horrible day. I had some, pretty much every training run I had on the course went really well and really built my confidence. But then for whatever reason, the day I actually was going to try and do all 14 of them in a row, I just felt terrible physically from the start, and then ended up, having some electrolyte issues or altitude issues, something. I got really swollen hands and just extremely low energy right from the start. So, yeah, it was a really sort of unsatisfying culmination to the whole process of really getting to know this line in the mountains. So I'm definitely going to go back and give it another shot. But probably not this year. Like I said, I want to kind of refocus on some proper racing goals this year or in 2014. And it'll be there. The mountains aren't going anywhere. So, yeah.
They're not shrinking.
Kind of where it is. Yeah. I guess the thing to say about Nolan's is that it's, I don't know. You know, we do these races in the ultra community of, you know, they're 100-milers and they're really tough. And then there's the Hard Rock 100, which everyone's just sort of like loses their mind about because of its difficulty. And Nolan's is on such a different level from that, even, that it's just sort of silly to even compare them. You know, it's so much more difficult than Hard Rock. you know, a race like Hard Rock, each pass is about 13,000 feet with 114 in there. And Nolan's, you go to 14K every single time. And there's no trail. I mean, at Hard Rock, you're on a trail the entire way. And Nolan's, you're route finding, and the footing is horrendous most of the time. And you're bushwhacking. And it's just, there's really even no comparison. It's a hard thing. And anyone who's finished it is, you know, they're, you know, have my respect for sure. And even just having sort of the audacity to give it a shot is also, yeah, I commend people that go for it. So it's a cool thing, though. It's because it's a really inspiring line in the mountains for me. And, yeah, I'd like to go back.
You know, that's what I wanted to bring up about that particular run, is that navigating that is an amazing feat in itself. In 100-mile runs, we're on a single-track trail that's so well-worn over the decades and the centuries. And then you have...
With ribbons.
Ribbons and glow sticks. And then you have cowbells ringing to let you know you're headed the right direction. Then you have somebody holding your hand and saying it's all downhill from here, and it's easy. You have all of that. But you're out there just with the moon and the stars and some courage packed in your sack, and that's it.
And from what I understand, if you're doing the Nolan's 14 challenge correctly, you cannot use a GPS. Is that correct?
Oh, I have no idea. No, I frankly don't care. No, I don't. I mean, I don't personally use a GPS, but I think any sort of rules that it's the mountains are there. You do them how you want, whatever style that you're inspired by and that is rewarding for you. I don't think there should be any rules, you know. It's a wilderness area, so yeah, you can't go take an ATV up and down these hills. But you know, it's whatever is satisfying. If you want to do it with a pacer, great. If you want to do it solo unsupported, great. You know, if you want to carry trekking poles and use those, fine by me, you know. If it takes you more than 60 hours, I don't care. You know, like I still think doing them a single push is huge. I don't know. Any of these arbitrary rules being imposed upon it, I think, is antithetical to the spirit of heading into the hills and challenging yourself in whatever way is personally satisfying.
You know, Tony,
I don't use GPS.
that brings me to a quote that I read. I think it may have been your race report on your blog. I can't remember where I read this, but you said, Placing one's athletic worth on the foundation of a fastest known time is inadvisable at best, most likely silly and delusional at worst. Such ambiguity should be a healthy reminder to focus on the experience of the process of simply moving quickly and efficiently in nature, embodying the most primal of activities, and not worrying about worrying unduly about the end goal result. I really like that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I probably get a little too high minded at times, but yeah, I think. I mean, because there's recently in the sport, there's been a lot more lip service paid to the whole concept of what an FKT is, and sort of going after certain ones, and you know how it should be documented. What you know, you should carry a spot, or you should have a GPS so it can be posted on Strava, and all this. And it's like, look. If you went out there and you had a good time and you know what you did and you're honest and you're reporting, that should be enough, you know? Like, so I don't know. I think there are a few exceptions, something like the Grand Canyon, which is done by a lot of people. You know, Rob Carr had an excellent run there this spring. Something like that should be commended by the larger community, possibly. I don't know if it should really be considered for like performance of the year type thing, but certainly he put out a monster effort, and that's awesome and inspiring to someone like myself. But yeah, I think sort of the whole spirit of an FKT or to the mountains is that it's a little more underground, a little more subversive than signing up for a race. And if in the end, you know, if you're like, I don't know, misreporting your results or your time, it's just silly, because like there's not even a, I don't know, like who's paying attention to begin with, you know? I don't know how people lie to themselves about this stuff, you know what I'm saying? Like it just doesn't even make sense to me, but I don't know. I guess that's my feeling on that.
and you know, based on that quote that Scott read, it really is, you know, the fastest known time for you, and that's what it's about. And we should really focus on not being selfish or self-centered, but think about our own personal journey and get the most out of that. Because if you're there just to break it, well, there's very few people that can break everybody's record, right? I mean, there's that animal
Correct.
Is pretty rare. But you know, we've got to go out there and just soak in the journey and just make a personal quest of it.
So. Yeah, I mean, I think a big reason a lot of us do this stuff is because we're trying to do something that we're not 100% sure we can accomplish, right? And that's going to be different for everybody, because we all have different abilities and we all have different potentials and we all have different strengths and weaknesses. So it's fun to start comparing with others, but I think that's why we try any of this stuff. But if you're doing this for some sort of like larger recognition, and then you're going to lie about it, I don't know. It just doesn't. I can't really even like make sense of it, you know.
So racing
is a whole different story, because there's rules, there's a start and finish line, and you play by the rules, and there's an accepted set of rules at the beginning and end and all that. But when it comes to like personal adventures in the mountains, it's, I don't know. I think the individual sets the parameters.
So how does Anton Kropichka deal with those negative voices when you're out there trying to do this Nolan's 14 and you said that, you know, your stomach wasn't doing too well, the day wasn't going real well for you. You already admitted you don't like to mask those feelings with ibuprofen or any kind of NSAIDs. When those negative thoughts start coming in your mind, how do you deal with that? How do you overcome those negative thoughts?
Well, clearly not too well, I guess. it's hard. And that's like the big challenge in this sport is being tough, basically. I don't know, I guess you have to sort of examine your motivations very honestly and decide whether quitting is the best option for the day, or are you going to be happier if you keep pushing, you know? And I don't know, it's always, that balancing act, because I don't know. For me, when I'm on the starting line of a 100-miler, I'm there. I shouldn't be lining up if I'm there, if I'm not there with 100% conviction to finish the race, you know? But I don't know. You have to, because there's always going to be, it's going to be really easy to find excuses during the race to quit, you know? Because you're in a lot of pain usually.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. There's always circumstances, and I'm always, to me, the ultimate value always is like my health and my ability to run. And whenever that's becomes, you know, compromised, it's kind of a no-brainer. And, you know, for instance, at Nolan's this past year, I was just, it was so, well, there ended up being a lot of logistical things, too, of like how easy, how much more difficult it would have been on everyone around me to bail later on, and just how poor the day was going anyhow. I don't know. It's always something you can only weigh in the moment, and it's really hard to second guess in hindsight. And I think it's really difficult to be on the outside, sort of looking in and making judgments about, you know, someone's commitment or whatever, because there's just really no way to know what that person was going through. And I try to remind myself of that whenever I'm, you know, I see someone else struggling or wanting to DNF.
That's got to be one of my pet peeves. There's a lot of people talking about ultra running and people writing blogs and questioning the motivation and reasons why people DNF or why they continue. That really bothers me. I think that's a personal choice, and you need to mind your own beeswax.
I think it depends. You know, especially in ultras, in races, or something like Nolan's this past summer, a lot of people like rallied to help me out. So it ends up being, I think it's important to think about how it's going to impact everyone around you as well, because these people have, you know, I mean, crewing for someone at ultra is a giant pain in the ass. You know, it's kind of a selfish thing, or selfless for the crew person, selfish for the runner. So it's important to think about that. But beyond sort of your immediate support network, yeah, I don't think you're beholden to anyone else's expectations.
Hey, Tony, I've asked this question on different podcasts, and I haven't even decided whether it's a good question or not.
so I keep asking it.
And that is, if you showed up to your A race, your 100-mile race, and you went up to the ultra genie that's there, and you were granted one wish, and that wish would be you either had the option of being 10% stronger or 10% mentally tougher, which would you accept at that in front of the genie, right? As you know, start at the beginning of the race.
What distance are we racing?
this is a 100-mile race.
Oh, I mean, absolutely, 10% extra mental strength. Yeah. I mean, the second half of the race is the last 40 miles of the race are all about mental strength. It's you're always stronger physically than what your mind is giving you credit for. It's whether your mind's tough enough to access that fitness, you know, and there's no question.
Go ahead, Scott.
No,
I was watching that movie, and again, it's a real treat to plug into that thing and pump up some motivation. And I saw that you were, it looks like you do a lot of climbing. I mean, serious climbing of scaling some rocks as part
usually
of your run.
On all fours.
And I've got I'm looking at that thinking now, you know, CrossFit. I mean, you've got some serious cross training going on there as you're scaling that thing on all fours. Have you noticed an improvement in your just overall power, strength, and running because of your mountain scaling, I'm going to call it?
I'm a climber. I do climb outside of running, you know, with ropes and harnesses and helmets and a whole bit.
Uh-huh.
What you're seeing in the movie is mostly what I would term more scrambling, which is, you know, it's easy fifth class, fourth class. I don't know. But no, I would call it more personal enjoyment, just a more satisfying way to engage the mountains, and has no discernible positive effect on my running or race fitness, you know?
Uh-huh.
You know, when I'm going up something like the first Flatiron, which is in the movie, I'm going at a high aerobic effort. You know, it's easy enough terrain that I can really get my heart rate up and be breathing, be completely anaerobic at the top, you know? Mm-hmm. But there's no races that require that kind of scrambling. So I think it's even detrimental to especially North American races and the vast majority of European races even. Yeah, it's more just it's a way I enjoy being in the mountains. I'm not doing it to prepare for a race.
You know, my biggest surprise of that movie was the shot of your toes. Holy Toledo. You've been rough on those toes.
Don't spoiler alert. No, come on, Don. You said no spoiler alert.
I know, but I didn't spoil it. I didn't give any details. You need to check in.
Those are not flip-flop toes.
No.
Well, except they are. Yeah, I don't know. I think most people who spend a lot of time on the trail end up pretty mangled toes eventually.
Yeah.
But the other thing is usually you go in a running shop and people are like, oh, you need like a thumb's length in the end of your shoe or something like that, right? And I don't know, running on technical terrain and especially scrambling, I like to have a pretty precise fit with my shoe, and I probably wear my shoes a little tighter than most.
All right.
Yeah.
So in the remaining short time we have, I do want to transition to the UTMB. And specifically, I know you spent a lot of time, at least from what I read and what I saw, you spent a lot of time in Europe this summer. How do you compare European trail ultra mountain running to the States?
Well, I've only done two races in Europe. One was this 50 miler in Spain last year, Cavalls de Vent, and then UTMB this year. It depends on what aspect of the sport you're talking about. Are you talking about the level of competition? Are you talking the style of the course? Are you talking sort of the organization of the race? Or all of the above?
All of the above, but let me narrow it down for you. We, United States runners, have gone over to the UTMB, and we haven't done real well.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that we can't compete, I don't want to put us in a bucket, but we really haven't been able to do real well. United States runners have not done well over in that race.
Okay, yeah. First, I'd want to say that it's U.S. North American women have generally crushed over there.
Mm-hmm.
Chrissy had the women's course record for, well, I guess until Rory broke it this year, and Rory just decimated it and was seventh overall. And Nikki won it a couple times, had the course record, I think. And so women have done pretty well. I will say that the depth in women's running just isn't the same as it is in men's. So that could be part of the explanation. But I don't know. It's I wouldn't say it's a mystery to me, but it's kind of a lot just going over to a different culture and integrating yourself into the scene. And racing, I think the number one thing for American men is Western States and Hard Rock are kind of the big deal here in the summertime. And so we kind of start the season real early and crush it at Western States, and then you're pretty tired. So you go over to UTMB fairly compromised. And I think that would be the biggest factor for North American men. And beyond that, I mean, I don't know, like Mike Foote was third last year. Tim Olson and Mike were fourth and fifth this year. I would say that Tim had a pretty compromised race. He's the kind of guy who should be able to win that race, but came in a little beat up and didn't have his best day. I don't know. I think you'll see an American man on the podium much of the coming years. You run all night, but the course itself is, I think, very similar to a lot of the courses in the States. Sure, there's 32,000 feet of climbing. Hard Rock has it a mile. Wasatch is a couple thousand feet, few thousand feet less than that. But the trail itself is unremarkable, and it's when comparing it to U.S. trails. They're similar steepness, similar lack of technical factors. It's a big, big race, you know? It's there's a lot of height. You go to Western States, you can barely tell a race is going on, you know? And you go to UTMB, and it's like you're running the Boston Marathon. It's absolute insanity. And if you're not careful with, sort of getting in over your head early on, you know, not going out too quickly, you can easily screw yourself. And there's a lot of different factors, but I know for me personally this year, it was just like came in with a little niggle, and anytime you run that far on the mountains, your structural weaknesses are going to be exploited. So by the time I got 86 miles in, there was no option left. But I don't have a good answer. Okay. I'm just rambling.
Anton, like you just mentioned, you know, Western States has a huge name for only 380 runners that show up in the you know, wee hours of the morning to get that thing started up that slope. There's, you know, we all know it and recognize the name and the event, but there's not a lot of folks out there with the bibs on.
Yeah, it's just exactly. It's what, an eighth the size of, not an eighth, maybe a seventh the size of UTMB in terms of participation. And especially in the States, the amount of like people surrounding a race is directly proportional to the number of people running it. Over in Europe, because generally the spectators at ultras in the States are either direct family members or friends or crew members of the people running the race. In Europe, it's sort of, you have like a beating heart and soul, you're out there watching the race, you know, like they just love it. And there's more of a feeling of community and sort of just a mountain culture, you know? And I don't know. I think Western's a pretty awesome event for what it is. And if I don't get into Hard Rock this year, I'm definitely planning on running Western States. And I don't know. It's a cool race though.
Absolutely, with a 15:13 as your last finish, you know, that's an incredible time out there. It was 2010 was a spectacular year.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the year I ran Western States, and in watching the top three guys this year, you know, Tim and Rob and Mike Morton go at it was super inspiring for me this year. And they're definitely my big motivation to return to the race next year if I don't get into Hard Rock. It's just, I just love head-to-head competition, and Western States still provides that, and will never lose sort of its, history and tradition and kind of fidelity to the, I don't know, what the sport was founded on, you know? And that's all inspiring stuff to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anton, we appreciate you joining us. Did you have something else, Scott?
No.
I thought I saw your sign going back up that you had a question.
No, the sign's on the floor.
Good.
Well, I think we've gotten to know you a lot better, I like to think that I'd like to embody some of your philosophy into my running. I love being out in nature. I love being up in the mountains, and that's what motivates me. A lot of the things that motivate you motivate me, although I think at a much different level. I'd like to get a little deeper into it than where I am right now. But we appreciate your time. We appreciate the fun blogs that you put on there. We'll actually link your blog.
It's at antonkrupicka.blogspot.com, Riding the Wind, the name of his blogspot.
And, of course, the video In the High Country by Joel Wolpert. We'll link that. Go, you Nation members, if you want to just see a good movie, I mean, if you're going to pay $10 to rent it, you might as well pay $15 to own it. And
because you want to watch it again.
Yeah, I don't know what that rental link is all about. That's something new. I don't know if that's Yeah, I don't know. I don't think Joel. I don't even know if Joel had any hand in putting that. I don't know what happened. Yeah.
Well, go buy it. It's 15. Yeah. You'd spend $15 to go to a Tom Hanks movie, wouldn't you?
Sometimes you.
And this is much better.
You pay $15 to drive to the trailhead sometimes.
That's right.
Buy that darn movie.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Tony. We appreciate it. Trail Nation members, go to trailrunnernation.com. Check out all the forums there. You see all the past podcasts. I was just telling Don earlier that I just listened today to an old podcast from 2012 with Carolyn Johnson about pacing, about what you should expect, what the pacer should expect, and how to communicate with your pacer. I thought it was a really good podcast. Make sure you get yourself some performance-enhancing Cocapelles. I bet you'd wear one of those, wouldn't you, Tony? If we sent you a performance-enhancing temporary tattoo Cocapelle, you'd wear one of those, wouldn't you?
I don't even know what you're talking about. Don't answer.
Just say yes. Yeah.
It's a tribal symbol, you know, part of the Trail Runner Nation, a Cocapelle that you can put temporarily on your calf is where people are usually putting it. And here's what we found, Tony. We found that people that wear these actually run faster, they recover quicker, they bonk less, and it's anecdotal at this point. We have Stephanie Howe that's a researcher that's on a previous podcast using her degrees and her PhD to study this phenomena, and we're finding out all the results right now are very favorable.
We find anecdotal data that it makes you better looking too.
Well,
sure.
Okay, good. We'll send you a couple, and you can let us know what you find.
Anyway, thanks for joining. Thanks for joining us, and go out and run,
Mas.
I'm Tony Kropichka, and I guess what I'm most known for is ultramarathons recently. I won the Leadville 100 last year, 2006, and the Rocky Raccoon 100 this year, 2007, in February. Planète N, planète gangrène, où tout va de plus en plus mal, ça se dégrade, même sur le plan local de Bagdad à Belgrade. Violence internationale, les mots sont remplacés par des balles, à l'aube d'une troisième guerre mondiale. I just really enjoy being outside and being in the mountains or being in the desert, being in the forest. And when you train for a 100-mile race, you get to go on like 4, 5, 6, 7 hour long runs. For me, trail running is performing in or engaging with the mountains that's most sincere, and that's why it's so important to me.
Les tolards, les gouines, les apprentis, les noirs, les piétons, les arabes, les français, les chevelus, les fous, les travestis, les anciens communistes, les abstentionnistes convaincus, tous ensemble pour leur foutre au cul. Oui, de bam bam, souffrant de servitude.